Listen and stream the all-new talk radio Freedom 106.5 for the only talk that matter.
As usual, on a Thursday morning, we present you Doctors on Call. We have, of course, Dr. Nadira Rambukas with us, and also joining us today, special guest doctor with us, Dr. Gordon Narayan Singh. Good morning, doctors.
Good morning, Govin. Good morning, Dr. Narayan Singh, and good morning, listeners. I hope Dr. Narayan Singh could hear us and he unmuted his chat.
Can you now? Good morning.
Yes. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning, everybody.
So I just want to briefly introduce Dr. Gordon Narayan Singh. He is a fellow of the Royal College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, and he is a specialist medical officer with the specialist register at the General Medical Council, UK. He's a former senior lecturer in obstetrician and gynecology at the University of the West Indies. He's also a former gynecologist from the Aberdeen Royal Infirmary. He's also a former consultant gynecologist at the San Fernando General Hospital. He's a consultant gynecological oncologist at St. James. He is also a consultant gynecological oncologist at Manchester, Newcastle, and Aberdeen. He is the recipient of the Medal of Merit Gold for Public Service for Medicine in 2014. And currently, he is a specialist medical officer, gynecological oncologist at the National Radiotherapy Center, St. James. He has over 50 international publications. Quite an extensive career and curriculum BT. And I just want to say that this segment is sponsored by PharmTech Caribbean Limited and Wellastra Advanced Women's Health, which is available nationwide at all pharmacies. It contains vitamin B's and herbal extracts. So welcome, Dr. Narayan Singh.
Thank you very much for inviting me to this forum, and happy Holy Corpus Christi to everybody in Trinidad and Tobago.
Thank you. So just getting into the grit of it, could you tell us how long you've been practicing medicine and what was your motivation for choosing medicine?
It's kind of embarrassing if I tell you how long I'm practicing medicine, because then you could figure out my age. But I did graduate in 1982, so that's 40 mm-hmm. years ago, and I became a member of the Royal College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists in 1988. So that's 35 years I've been in the specialty of obstetrics and gynecology. And that's more than half of my lifetime that I've been practicing in women's health and serving actively. I've taken any time off, no sabbaticals. I have moved between Trinidad and Tobago and United Kingdom on several occasions. In fact, when I calculate, I think I must have spent about 10 years total of my career in the UK working, not on a holiday, and actually doing my training, initial training, and then working as a consultant in gynecological oncology at the different hospitals, big hospitals in the United Kingdom. So that is, you know, in essence, my time span, my lifespan in this field.
So was there any particular experience, event, or patient that motivated you to do obstetrics and gynecology, and particular oncology?
Well, what I would say is that I will advise young doctors coming through, is to choose your career as early as possible to get a head start. So in my fifth year of medical school, I was really, really excited about the buzz on labor ward and the deliveries, taking patients to theater for emergency cesarean sections, the turnover, the happiness and joy associated with obstetrics deliveries, and for the mother and of course the father and the family being so happy that they have had an addition to their family, was extremely exciting.
Right.
So I actually, in my final year, I decided I was going to do obstetrics and gynecology. So that actually gave me a real good platform to move on quickly, get into the specialty, and get going. Now, the second question is about why did I go on to oncology? So when I came back from Britain in 1988, I was posted in, I think I was in Port of Spain for a while, registered there with Dr. Wong. And then I was sent to San Fernando General Hospital. They had a fair amount of the consultants had retired. Dr. Paran Singh, Dr. Rajendra Ram Kisun, and Dr. Harnarayan, Percival Harnarayan. Some of you all will know him. So there was a great void in services in San Fernando in the south. And Dr. John McLean called me and I asked me if I could come down. And they, in those days, there was no regional health authority. So under the Ministry of Health, so they could post you anywhere in Trinidad and Tobago. So they sent me down to San Fernando in 1989 as an acting consultant. And then I saw the amount of bad disease, bad cervical cancer, large ovarian masses, bad gynecological cancers, and completely helpless. So it started to my interest in trying to see how best I could help these ladies, because I couldn't really do much because I wasn't in any exposure to gynecological oncology. In fact, that was even my subspecialty at that time. So I persisted, I joined the university, and I never gave up. And then eventually I wrote the Royal College of Professional Gynecologists in 1996. And they had now started their training programs. And I was able to get into a fellowship program in 1998 at Aberdeen Royal Infirmary in Scotland. I just left. I dropped everything. I got no pay leave from the, I was at the university at that time, in the University of West Indies. Packed my bag and I went straight to Aberdeen Royal, and I did my fellowship in gynecological oncology under the supervision of the Royal College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. And here I became a certified specialist in gynecology oncology. In fact, that was the second group of graduates or fellows from the UK. So I was in that second group that came out of the 11 regional centers at that time. So since then, I came back in 2000 as a fellow, gynecology oncology fellow, and I continued to work in the field back and forth between here and the UK.
And how has obstetrics and gynecology changed from since then till now?
Well, obstetrics, I'm not as much as exposed to obstetrics as in gynecology, but I will tell you that obstetrics has become much more sophisticated. The high quality ultrasounds and anomaly scanning, the use of Dopplers, we have moved away from invasive testing to we use these blood tests now for fetal anomaly assessment. In the old days, we'd have to use amniocentesis, see coronary filler sampling. That is no longer done because you can source fetal blood from the maternal blood sample, fetal cells actually, and therefore we can do all the chromosomal analysis with minimal amount of intervention. High quality ultrasounds have made it very, very good to pick up anomalies, and of course fetal monitoring, fetal growth has also, charting has improved. In addition to that, I want to tell you is that the birth rate in Trinidad has dropped tremendously. When I was a young consultant in San Fernando and in Port of Spain, but particularly San Fernando, we would deliver about 7,500 deliveries a year. I'm not sure what the statistics are now, but I would tell you that in those days, we were delivering 28,000, that's in the early 90s, 28,000 babies a year in Trinidad. And now, lo and behold, we're delivering 13,000. With that, Nadira, or Dr. Rambokas, if you have less babies and you have more obstetricians and gynecologists, you have better one-to-one care, so to speak, so that we don't have, that has improved also, the amount of specialist obstetricians and gynecologists we have in the country, and we have less deliveries, less pregnancies, so we should have better attention to our pregnant mothers. So that has improved also. So we find that, and Dr. Sergio Singh has remarked about it, that the maternal mortality has now become almost a thing of the past, which is fabulous. So we are making great strides in obstetrics, but I'm not an obstetrician, practicing obstetrician, but I'm an obstetrician gynecologist, and I do read some articles and keep in touch with my colleagues. But in gynecology, that has also changed tremendously into minimal invasive type surgery. We're now moving away from big open laparotomies to laparoscopic surgery. We are moving away from the T's and C's to hysteroscopic assessment of the endometrium. All our trainees now are adept in using the ultrasound, transvaginal ultrasound, to assess uterine and ovarian pathology. So we have moved in that direction positively. I feel very excited right now, although I'm 35 years in this field. I have seen technology and I've seen resources improve in Trinidad and Tobago, that we are now reaching a capability to almost offer a service as our first world colleagues. And I have been exposed to the first world. I worked in Britain for 10 years, so I understand what Western medicine is like in developed countries. And I would say Trinidad is not that way behind at all. In our field of obstetrics and gynecology, I feel very comfortable to say that with a certain amount of conviction. So that has been the two arms, obstetrics and gynecology. They are moving apart. And now you're getting people who are just doing obstetrics, and particularly those in maternal and fetal medicine. And you're getting people who are moving away into the gynecological areas of reproductive medicine, benign gynec conditions. That's a specialty by itself. Gynecological oncology is another specialty. So we are becoming much more in doing much, not as wide, but as deep in our clinical skill. We're getting experts in different fields. Within the specialty, which actually adds value to the whole specialty. And it improves the quality to our clientele, which is the women, the fortunate women, I would say, because I went to the islands, and I think in Trinidad and Tobago, we are very fortunate to have such a good service. And I'm not prompted by anybody from the ministry or anything. This is my unadulterated opinion.
Thank you. Quite an achievement. So we're switching gears a little bit. What exactly is endometriosis? We're talking about a particular disorder that affects a lot of women, and it's something that you're passionate about. And can you explain what it is and how it occurs?
Endometriosis is a really unfortunate disease among young women. And I mean... I sometimes make the statement, if you don't like somebody, you know, wish that they have endometriosis, because it is one of the, to be very strong spoken, it is a curse among women's gynecological health. The problem of endometriosis, compared to say like fibroids or a large ovarian cyst, most of this disease, you cannot see it. Gynecologists and clinicians may not be able to ascertain it on a pelvic examination. But you have to entertain the probability that a young lady has endometriosis if she has severe dysmenorrhea or period pains, as we say, or pains in during the mid-cycle in particular, pain with intercourse, severe back pain, heavy periods, pain on passing stool. Some of the women, they have, it sometimes involves the colon. And they get that sort of tenesmus and deep-seated pain. And therefore, this is where the lining of the uterus, the endometrium, that is which a woman sheds every month, unfortunately, either because of during the embryological development, or because sometimes the menstrual products do reflux through the fallopian tubes and gets into the pelvis, this bits of endometrial tissue get stuck around the tubes and the ovaries, the back of the uterus, around the ligaments that support the uterus, onto the colon, over the bladder, and these continue to grow every month, and they shed, but there's no exit. It doesn't come through the vagina. It remains in the pelvis, pooling there, and it causes the fluid and the tissue that is released is extremely irritant. And it creates a chemical kind of inflammation. So it's not like an inflammation with an infection, but it's a chemical inflammation. And that causes lots of scarring. And it's the scarring in particular that causes the disease and the disability. some women unfortunately scar more than others, and therefore it is the risk spectrum of endometriosis is quite varied and wide. Some women will have bad endometriosis in terms of volume of disease and will have minimal amount of pain and can go ahead and have babies. And unfortunately, some women with minimal endometriosis can have severe pain. So the correlation of the amount of endometriosis and your symptoms is not a direct one. It is very, very wide and varied. And the cause of the varying clinical presentation, Dr. Rambukas, and by extension, the listeners, it is very difficult sometimes. A lot of patients are missed, the misdiagnosis. And this, I'm not blaming anybody here, because the European report on human reproduction said one of the major problems of endometriosis is a late diagnosis. And I'm not, and it's, you're surprised to hear that it takes about almost 10 years in Europe for a woman to, from a clinical symptom, when you go back to back data history, to diagnosis, 10 years. In the United States, it's about 8 years, and in Britain, it's about just under 8 years, 7.8, 7.9 years, to reach the stage where the person, the woman, is diagnosed with clinical endometriosis. So one of the major variables, and this is a concern internationally, is delayed diagnosis. So what we have to do, and I'm glad you've asked me to speak on endometriosis a bit, is that we have to entertain that different, as a in a woman, young woman with pelvic pain, you have to entertain that endometriosis has to be one of the clinical conditions you have to consider early on. Because the earlier we pick it up, the earlier we can manage it, and therefore we can avoid this young person developing debilitating period pain, and also, Dr. Rambukas, affecting adversely her reproductive system, because there is a relationship between subfertility and endometriosis.
So we have to take a short commercial break, and when we come back, we'll talk more about endometriosis, how it's diagnosed, and how it can affect fertility. So we'll be back shortly.
Talk is streaming at freedom106.5.com.
And welcome back to Doctors on Call with Dr. Nadira Rambukas and Dr. Gordon Narain Singh.
Thank you, Govin. This segment is sponsored by Wellestra Advanced Women's Health, and we are talking today about endometriosis. And Dr. Narain Singh, does endometriosis have a genetic component? And to how many women in Trinidad and Tobago are affected by endometriosis?
It'd be difficult to let me answer your second question, please. It'd be difficult to say how many women, but the international data, and I will transcribe that data, roughly about 12 to 15% of women in the reproductive age group will have some endometriosis. Now, how many of them really have bad endometriosis to clinically present? Because I will tell you that we pick up endometriosis sometimes even at normal surgery. You know, you're doing a surgery for, say, a caesarean section, you may see endometriotic implant. At tubal sterilization, you might see endometriosis. But roughly about 10 to 15% of women in the reproductive age group will have endometriosis. So the question about a genetic component, that is, it's more and more felt that endometriosis has many, it's multifactorial, many etiologies. And there is, it runs in families. That's point one. I've noticed that among sisters, mother, aunt, daughters. But we feel that it's hard to conceptualize even the reproductive system, and when it's being developed in the female fetus, it undergoes different, certain tissues have to be reabsorbed to develop the uterus and the fallopian tubes. And that is what that system is called, the Müllerian system. And the Müllerian system also, the component is the endometrium. Now, when that system is partially reabsorbed, it means deposits of malarian tissue, which go on eventually in adulthood to change into endometrium, is stuck within the pelvic area. So that what happens is that these malarian tissue now develop into endometrial tissue, become activated as the young girl develops some ovarian activity during puberty, and stimulates these tissues, and that will be developed into endometriosis. And the thing also you have to understand also is that the theory is so diverse, because Mr. Ian Ramnarayan, who is a top cardiothoracic respiratory surgeon, he will tell you that he has many battles with women with endometriosis within the pulmonary or the lung system. In fact, a couple of times he's called me asking for advice about patients with bad endometriotic implants within the pulmonary system. It is found under the diaphragm also. It can be found in the umbilicus. It can be found in surgical scars. Post-surgery, you can find nodules of endometriosis. So it's a very, very interesting disease. It is the greatest masquerader. We feel that Peter Minchell might be the greatest masquerader in Trinidad and Carnival. But I would tell you, endometriosis is one of the greatest masqueraders in clinical medicine. It presents in so many diverse patients. May have even intracerebral endometriosis also. So it's majority of it is in the pelvic area, but it can be also extra pelvic, if I have to sum it up in that capacity.
Right. And because of the wide range of symptoms, how is it usually diagnosed? Ultrasound symptoms, or is it basically other type of radiological testing?
That is a very good question, because the gold standard for diagnosing endometriosis is doing a laparoscopic assessment by putting a camera into the patient's abdomen and pelvis and looking to identify implants and biopsying it. Now, we all have to be realistic here. It's very difficult to have every woman who has severe pelvic pain and dyspareunia to have a laparoscopic assessment. Although in the United Kingdom, the endometriosis regional centers, and the guidelines are saying that women should have a laparoscopic assessment if they have persistent pelvic pain for more than 6 months. Now, the thing is, first of all, you have to have a strong clinical impression. And I have made my own triad. I don't want to put a name on it. I don't put Dr. Narayan Singh's clinical symptom triad. But a woman who has the two out of the three, I would consider strongly likely to have endometriosis. One, every month they have progressively worsening pain. And this pain, how I quantitate this pain, or qualitate, is that they take increasing doses and types of analgesia to combat the pain. You see, one of the things is that women, unfortunately, get very little sympathy from their family, their colleagues, if they have period pain, because that is just a part of womanhood. So when you start complaining of period pain, you're kind of apologizing about it. And that is so unfortunate. So that if a woman, if somebody has a chest pain, so if a chest pain, everybody's alarmed. They send them for an ECG, they do bloods to check if you have an MI, you send you for an echo, etc. You have period pain. Your pelvic pain, well, it's period pain. You expect that. So you know what? Take some tablets and cool yourself. And that is the unfortunate thing about endometriosis. It is ignored. The symptoms are ignored because we accept pelvic pain as a consequence of the female reproductive system. So it is ignored. So the first criteria is increasing progressive pain every month. That's criteria number one. The second criteria is pain is so bad and so debilitating, you cannot function. So you have to lie down with a hot water bottle You have to, you can't go to work. If you're going to school, you cannot attend classes, and you struggle during those 2 or 3 days every month. Your life is come to a complete halt during that time. And the last clinical symptom that I use is the pain. You get gastrointestinal side effects now. You start getting vomiting, you get diarrhea, you get severe pain with bowel movements, and that is also highly suspicious of endometriosis. So those are the three clinical symptoms that I use, and if you have two of those three, I'm strongly entertaining. And the other one, which is a parallel, is unable to get pregnant and trying. So then we come on to clinical examination. Unfortunately, and I want to stress this, and I'm not attacking my colleagues, a lot of us, and this has been published in the Royal College Journal, that clinicians are not doing digital examinations anymore. They're using a transvaginal ultrasound and using the ultrasound to look at the cervix, the uterus, the endometrium, the ovaries. And they're forgetting that one of the important components of clinical medicine is your fingers, your hands, palpating. Clinical digital examination will identify one, focal tenderness, and that's a clinical feature suspicious of endometriosis. Not generalized tenderness, because that is more with a pelvic inflammatory disease. Two, you may feel nodularity around the fornices of the upper vagina. Three, if there's bad scarring, the uterus becomes very difficult it becomes fixed and therefore decreased mobility. And you should pick that up clinically with a digital examination. And four, you can feel tethering and scarring or nodule and of the uterus sacral ligaments. That clinical digital examination is sometimes unfortunately ignored because we put in the TV probe and we forget to do a digital examination. I am just as culpable as some of my other as the rest of clinicians sometimes are missing that. And then, so that will give you stronger evidence with the clinical symptoms and this, that you're on to endometriosis. And then you could use the ultrasound. And you may see chocolate cystic endometriomas around the ovary. You might see the uterus is retroverted and fixed. You might notice fluid in the pouch of Douglas, which is the inflammatory fluid as a result of endometriosis. But also there's a sign called the sliding sign of moving the ovary. Now, all of us when we're in medical school, we know the ovary is suspended behind the uterus on the ovarian ligaments, and they dangle. They're like a fruit hanging on a tree, on a branch. When there's endometriosis, the scarring around the ovaries make them immobile. And there is a sign called the sliding sign that you can use your hand and palpate over the abdomen and look at the transvaginal probe at the ovary. And if the ovary can move up and down, that is means that it is sliding. That means there's no scarring. But if you try to move the ovary up and down and stop, then of course, unfortunately, that's a positive sliding sign. And that indicates endometriosis. So there are many ways before we can entertain endometriosis than offering patients laparoscopic evaluation. I feel laparoscopic is the gold standard, and that will always continue. MRI scans are also used for endometriosis, but that's a very expensive investigation, and I tend to discourage it. Maybe in deep-seated endometriosis, which is infiltrating into the pelvic sidewall, along the nerves, into the rectal vaginal septum, along to the bowel wall, you may have to use an MRI. But I would reluctantly not use an MRI, and I rarely use it for endometriosis. I might use it for another condition related to endometriosis. It's called adenomyosis, which is also a very unfortunate condition to have.
Right. Thank you, Dr. Narayan Singh. We have to take a short commercial break, and when we come back, we'll talk about the treatment options for endometriosis and minimally invasive surgery.
Talk is streaming at freedom106.5.com.
And welcome back to Freedom 106.5 FM. We resume with Doctors on Call with Dr. Rambukas, and of course, joining us, Dr. Narayan Singh, speaking about endometriosis.
Thank you, Govind. Dr. Narayan Singh, is there a dietary component to endometriosis? Like, is there anything women should avoid once they're diagnosed, or anything that would aggravate the condition?
That's a very good question. No, this is just my hypothesis, but not really a hypothesis. I have some strength with this argument. Now, we know that endometriosis thrives when there's a lot of estrogens on board. So when a woman produces a lot of estrogens from her ovary, so one of the components of treatment of endometriosis is to stop ovarian estrogen production to allow the endometriosis to die out, so to speak. So, but we also know, Dr. Rambukas, that estrogen can be non-ovarian and it is produced in body fat. So tissues, your body fat will convert one of the hormones that produced from your adrenal cortex through an enzyme within the body fat into a weak estrogen. And that estrogen will also support the sustainability of the endometriosis. So if you have a high fat diet and your body fat is higher, then of course, and you're not subscribing to that natural healthy lifestyle, your extra estrogen that you're producing from the tissues will obviously potentiate your endometriosis. That's number one. Plus, it inhibits your ovulation, and when you ovulate, you produce progesterone, and progesterone has a negative effect on endometriosis. It suppresses endometriosis. We use progestogens to treat endometriosis, and if you're not ovulating, when you have high fat estrogens, you are adding fuel to the fire. So that is one. My other take on this is that I've been in clinical medicine, as I told you, for a long time, and I work both in the public and the private sector. I rarely see women in the public sector with endometriosis. I see more women in the private sector with endometriosis. And it might be societal. It might be that women in the public sector who see us in the hospital, they tend to start their families early, and they may have the potential to develop endometriosis, but early pregnancies when you're in your 20s, because when a woman becomes pregnant, they don't have a period for 9, and then they breastfeed, and they might continue for another 6 to 9 months again. So almost a year and a half, they have no periods. And we know that endometriosis is related to your periods. And therefore, if women have pregnancies earlier, that potential threat of developing clinical endometriosis is negated, and that helps. So women are postponing their pregnancies for later on, and they're allowing the endometriotic tissue and the implants to develop. So that's a sort of a lifestyle change. I'm not saying being harsh in any group, then I'm blaming anybody fit, but you ask me a question, I'm answering it in a clinical capacity. And I also feel that sedentary behavior allows for endometriosis to develop. Sitting is one of the worst things you could ever do, because sitting jackknifes your flow of blood from your legs up to your heart. So it doesn't go up the inferior vena cava into your heart and then out through the aorta. It pools in your pelvis. It's like one big traffic jam. It's like the traffic jam sometimes you see, or you used to have it on the Churchill Roosevelt Highway around by the Uriah Butler. There was piles of traffic. However, if you get up and you get going and you move, you reduce that pelvic congestion. And if the circulation within the pelvis is improved, whatever little bits of endometriotic implants which may occur following retrograde menstruation is allowed to disseminate and move around. And therefore, women who are in the lower socioeconomic group, who for their own circumstances are beneficiaries because they're more active. They have to go out and work. They have to go and they're doing more manual type work. They're in the shop selling, and they're doing cleaning work, etc. And they actually have, they're much more fitter, paradoxically, than the girls who go for 1 hour in the gym and sit 8 hours on a desk, and in a chair behind a desk. And that is the group I fear for, because they're not as ambulant as the other group. So activity will help, reducing your fat diet, and of course, starting your family earlier. These are the three things I want to take home message here. We're trying to reduce the likelihood of developing clinical endometriosis. I think a lot of women have endometriosis, but some of them, unfortunately, migrate on to develop clinical endometriosis with disease, debilitating disease, and problems with getting pregnant, subfertility.
And what are some of the other treatment options that are available, both medically and surgically, besides the pill?
So I did kind of add, say that, you know, anything that stops estrogen will suppress endometriosis. But stopping estrogen is not a thing to do, because a woman depends on her femininity with estrogen. So it could only be temporarily stopped, maximally maybe 6 months, by giving certain injections to suppress the ovarian activity. And in some patients with bad endometriosis, especially those who are trying to get pregnant, you may give them some injections to suppress it, get the body to get rid of all the endometriosis, the body's natural immune state system will get in and get rid of it, and you allow the tissues to regenerate, healthy tissues to regenerate, and then after stopping the treatment, you hopefully encourage your patient to go ahead and conceive. So medical therapy is used, progestogens, there are certain tablets on the market that are available. One of the downsides, and this is important, because women start using these medical therapies fairly early in their career, in their life, is osteoporosis. And I have a noteworthy amount of women who have picked up, who have been treated extensively for endometriosis, and unfortunately have developed osteoporosis. And that is because they block the estrogen so long. And estrogen is very important for bone health, and therefore they've lost bone. So there's always going to be a give and take and a trade-off. One of the more and more common is surgery. And we can do surgery on these patients invariably with laparoscopy and resecting all the implants. In the old days, and I was just as guilty, is that we just go and zap them and burn them out, cauterize them as I see them. But cauterizing is not very good. It's like you destroy maybe 75% of it. You leave a few cells and they regenerate. And also cauterizing in its own capacity causes scarring. So what I tend to do now is excision of the endometriotic implant. Quite painstaking, because we have to resect all the disease along the pelvic sidewall. There are lots of important structures that run in the pelvic sidewall, particularly the large vessels that supply blood to your leg, some of the nerves, as well as the ureter that takes urine from the kidney to the bladder that courses through the pelvis. And these have to be, when you're doing surgical resection, laparoscopic resection for endometriosis, you have to make sure one has to be very careful not to traumatize these tissues, and therefore you have to have the familiarity of being a laparoscopic surgeon, comfortable to do that extensive dissection or resection. And if you've done, if that is done, and you excise the implants, these patients do invariably quite well.
Right. Can endometriosis recur?
Oh, yeah. Endometriosis, I tell all my patients, is a chronic condition. Just as how people have diabetes, hypertension, they will have endometriosis. Is a chronic condition that will never ever go away, but you can control it and you can live your life. Well, it will go away when the woman reaches menopause, because obviously the estrogen is no longer produced, because the ovaries don't produce any estrogen anymore, and therefore the they will go into, you know, complete, I would say, remission. But in the reproductive age group, as long as they have their ovaries there, they will be having some, endometriosis will be present. However, women, and I love women, Trinidadians, patients, people, manage their hypertension very well with good medication, and they do their exercise and their diet, and they stop their salt and everything, and they use all the natural techniques, lifestyle changes. Women, people with diabetes, lose weight, they watch what they eat, and they live a full life. And therefore, that doesn't mean that you are now labeled and scarred for life because you have endometriosis. If you manage it properly, you can continue to live a good quality life. And your gynecologist should follow you up, make sure that if you're developing any early symptoms, address these symptoms as early as possible so you don't get into a fulminating problem.
Okay, thank you, Dr. Ryan Singh. We have to take a short commercial break, and when we come back, we'll talk about minimally invasive surgery.
Talk is streaming at freedom106.5.com.
9:51, welcome back to Freedom 106.5 FM and Doctors on Call. We've got with us Drs. Rambukas and Dr. Narain Singh.
Thanks, Govin. And this segment is sponsored by Wellstra Advanced Women Health. It contains B vitamins and herbal extracts and is available at all pharmacies nationwide. So, Dr. Narain Singh, moving on to minimally invasive surgery. Is this, for instance, like similar to laparoscopic surgery, or are there newer techniques available?
Well, minimal invasive surgery is the term we use for anything that we don't have to make a big incision. So it doesn't have to be confined to gynecology. So anything, and I would say that, but laparoscopy is a component of the minimal invasive surgery. For example, I do hysteroscopy, which is minimal invasive, where I can remove polyps, fibroids from the uterine cavity, resect scar tissue, resect septums from the uterus, without having to cut the patient anymore. I can go through the cervix with the camera and do that. So that's a component of minimal invasive surgery. By and large, in gynecology, the two areas, hysteroscopy, which I just explained, and of course, laparoscopy, where we can do a lot of procedures, laparoscopic, in gynecology now than before. In fact, there are limitations. Of course, one of the major problems with doing laparoscopic surgery is when you have to remove the, say, like a big fibroid or a large ovarian mass, is to get it out through a small incision. And that is where the challenge is. But by and large, a significant amount of surgery can be done with using the laparoscope. Endometriosis, as we talked about, we can do that. We can remove ovarian cysts. We can do laparoscopic hysterectomies. That is becoming more and more fashionable. In fact, in next month, I am presenting in Belize in the Caribbean College of Surgeons a short case series of patients who I did laparoscopic hysterectomies earlier this year, and they went home the same day. So my title of that presentation is called Sleeping in Your Own Bed, Laparoscopic Hysterectomy. So you're sleeping in your own bed at night. And that is what is a driver, in that women are not averse to having surgery. You know, my clients, what is the concern, and you hear it all the time, is that the modern woman has such a compact itinerary and a diary that they always have a meeting, they have a wedding to go to, they have a social event, they have to travel, they want to go to the gym, they have to drop children to school, etc., etc., etc. And when you tell them they have to have surgery because they have a problem, and they accept that, they want to know how quickly they can get back to their normal lifestyle. And that now has been a challenge among all of us in the realm of surgery, getting people back to their normal activity as quickly as possible. And the aspect of the minimal invasive surgery, laparoscopic surgery, affords that. So that you find, in fact, a couple of weeks ago, one of my patients came to remove her stitches 1 week after having a laparoscopic hysterectomy. So I said, how are you going back home? She said, doc, I drove to take my stitches out. So she, 1 week later, she has driven her car to the office to take her stitches out for after having laparoscopic hysterectomy. So the point is that it does offer that. That's a big selling point, want this, of a better word, of people getting back to their normal activity, they're getting back to their gym, etc., as quickly as possible. Because, as I said, all of us, as I'm sure you have, and I definitely have, a very tight schedule. So anything that affects that schedule, it disrupts us. And if you could get people back online as quickly as possible, they want to play their mask, they want to have go down the islands, etc., they can enjoy it. So I think that's a main selling point. I feel also it's safer. Post-operative recovery is faster. The risk of getting blood clots is less. The risk of getting chest infections. The wounds are minimal, so there's minimal wound chance of wound infections. Healing is faster. And as you know, Dr. Rabokas, the quicker we get people off ambulated for any surgery, there's extremely great evidence, the whole aspect of improvement by their muscle mass and preservation of their muscle mass and their muscle tone, the return to normal bowel functions properly and quickly, they rest less likely to get chest infections, and of course, they're less likely, most importantly, to get clots in their legs and getting a life-threatening pulmonary embolus. So minimal invasive surgery has really, really revolutionized surgery. And I'm hoping that I will encourage some of you trying later this year. I'm trying to pilot within the hospital system, getting some of the juniors to start doing some more, be comfortable with it needs expertise. It's not a procedure that can be done without good training and supervision. And we're hoping to do some workshops later in the year to help our registrars to become more comfortable with laparoscopic surgery. And that's in the pipeline.
And how do we decide, like, who are candidates for these types of surgery as opposed to open?
Well, if you have a large uterus, maybe over the above the umbilicus, it's unlikely we can take that out laparoscopic. If you have large fibroids, that would be difficult to remove. Women with maybe bad scar tissue, but scarring is not a complete contraindication. You can meticulously remove, separate a lot of scarring and free the tissues up and take it out safely. The only major contraindication is a large uterus, a large, you know, ovarian mass. And of course, if there's ovarian cancer, you're obviously, it's unlikely you can do most of it laparoscopic, but we are doing endometrial cancers, we do the remove the uterus, the tubes and the ovary and the lymph nodes. The pelvic lymph nodes can be removed laparoscopic. In fact, that is the gold standard now in the UK. The guidelines are in quality that maybe over 75% of women with endometrial cancer should have it done laparoscopic. So the contraindications are few. We do tell all the patients that if they're having laparoscopic surgery, there we have sometimes to open. We can convert an open procedure. The conversion rate is extremely low. My conversion rate is like less than about maybe 1% or so. But you select those patients. So I'm doing a patient this weekend with she's endometrial cancer and with pulmonary hypertension. I'm working out with she will benefit from minimal invasive surgery because she recover faster. And the other thing, the great paradox is that the women who have a high BMI or they have a high fatty abdomen are greater beneficiaries of minimal invasive surgery, because wound healing in women with large abdominal girth and lots of body fat is very bad with open surgery. In fact, when I was in 2004, I piloted a whole project of doing a endometrial cancer laparoscopic for women with a BMI of over 40, which is fairly grossly obese. So the big ladies actually are more likely to get laparoscopic surgery, and be more inclined to offer them if they're going to have a hysterectomy, because their wound healing and their recovery is so much better compared to if they had an open surgery. They have a huge scar. They have to come in every day for dressings. They get breakdown of the tissues, and it's a nightmare. And I've gone through it. I've seen patients that I've operated on with delayed healing, and I very upset with myself that I didn't. And then, therefore, in 2004 in Britain, in Scotland, when we started laparoscopic surgery, I was one of the first guys in Scotland to say, let's try and do this laparoscopic, because the wound healing is going to be far superior than an open procedure. So,
we just have a quick question, Dr. Narain Singh, from Sandine WhatsApp. Is an anti-inflammatory diet appropriate for endometriosis? If we could be quick, because our time is almost up.
Inflammatory diet, I would say, what is an anti-inflammatory diet? The point is that your diet has to have a lot of fruits and vegetables, because you have healthy gut bacteria, which needs that fruits and vegetables. Not the orange juice, but eat the orange. Healthy bacteria, healthy diet will improve your gut bacteria, and therefore your gut bacteria will selectively assimilate healthy products into your body, and that will make you healthy. And if you are healthy, then the tendency for you to develop clinical endometriosis, because you may have been born with it, but the tendency to develop endometriosis that becomes debilitating, as some people have family history of diabetes, their mother and father are diabetic, but they don't have to be diabetic if they eat well and they exercise well and they control their carbohydrate intake, they will be benefit. So I emphasize an anti-inflammatory diet will definitely be a diet of vegetables and fresh fruits. And I would emphasize local fruits. Don't try and buy these foreign imported fruits. I don't know what they have in them. They have a lot of wax over these fruits that preserve their integrity, and I'm questioning these fruits. There are lots of lovely pawpaws, mangoes, watermelons, pineapples in our country. We are very blessed with these fruits. Please enjoy these fruits and do not try and discourage buying these imported stuff, okay? Because that is inflammatory. The wax on that apple is inflammatory, okay?
We want to thank you, Dr. Narain Singh, for being educational and informative. I want to thank my co-host and our listeners. And we'll be back next week for more Doctors on Call. Enjoy your day.
Thank you again.
Thank you very much, Dr. Rambukas, for having me on this morning. And I thoroughly enjoyed the program. And I hope that I have been of some benefit to the listeners and the wider population. Thanks a lot.
Thank you so much. Of course, there, Dr. Narain Singh and Dr. Rambukas, right here on Freedom 106.5 FM for Doctors on Call today, right here on Freedom 106.5 FM.
Talk is streaming at freedom106.5.com.